Richard Verone. I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Wilson Harrison. Today is April 23rd, 2003 at 8:36 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas at the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Harrison, you're in Sumter, South Carolina. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Great. Why don't we start with some basic biographical information on yourself? Can you tell me when and where you were born and just a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Richland, Mississippi, October 7, 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, you know, from my birth all the way up.
Well, whatever you're comfortable with. Just tell me a little bit about your childhood. How many siblings did you have?
Well, I had 9 sisters and brothers.
Wow, big family.
Yeah, it's a bunch of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What'd your parents do?
My father was in the Army.
Okay.
He served in Vietnam and World War II and the Korean War.
Hmm. What did he do in those wars?
He was a military police officer.
Okay.
And all my brothers served in the military.
Really?
And none of my sisters.
Uh-huh.
But basically, I went to school and came from school. I come into the Air Force.
Now, how much of an influence was your father and your brothers of you going into the military?
Well, I was the oldest brother that went into the military.
Ah.
My father was in the military. My grandfather was also in the military, World War II.
Wow. Okay.
But they was all in the Army. I was the first one that ever come into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about, what do you remember about your childhood growing up in Mississippi?
Well, I was born an Army dependent, so really growing up in Mississippi is just part of it.
Okay.
You know, I lived in a bunch of states, so, you know, it was back and forth in Mississippi, but to me it was, you know, just growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an experience in a way you go
mm-hmm.
back in that time frame.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Tell me about your schooling. Did your parents emphasize education to you?
Oh, we had to go to school. We had no choice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, education was it. You know, you didn't have no choice. You went to school. That was just fact.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Did you do any jobs when you were young?
Oh, yeah. I started working when I was 9 years old.
Really?
Believe it or not. I started off in a nursery. And from a nursery, I worked at, you know, we plant flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in a hothouse first, and then I went out into the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Then we learned how to do yard care, which she was spraying, using, believe it or not, DDT and benzene hexachlorac.
Oh, boy.
And the chintz bugs and the centipede grass and the
mm-hmm.
St. Augustine grass. You know, I can remember all that, you know. But that's where we started off. And I went from there to a bank and count pennies in a 6-cent soda machine. Well, I counted the pennies, and my godfather counted the nickels. I used to help him in the bank.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, it was, believe it or not, to the air. I worked concrete work, you know, for John Reese in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I did footings, driveways, brick homes, and then from there to the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So you worked a variety of jobs growing up.
Sure did. We had to work. 9 kids, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So your income contributed to the family income.
Oh, yeah. Everybody pitched in. In the summertime, we would all rake yards and put the money down on our table in the evening. We all had to buy our clothes and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Army didn't make that much, and my mother worked, too. So we did good, you know. We never went a day without eating, I tell you that.
Yeah. What did your mother do?
My mother worked off and on in the commissary and the PX on the base.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which city did you live in for the longest time, or what do you, when you think of your childhood growing up, is there any one city that you see?
That's kind of hard. Moving all the time, you know.
Right.
Really kind of hard. But I guess you could say, I graduated in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Rowan High School.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess you can say that.
Okay.
Hattiesburg would be the closest to Camp Chevron, Mississippi, which is an Army post.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most years, and after that, I guess it would be then become South Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about your high school years. What kind of student were you?
I was a good student. I was number 33 in the class.
Really?
Yeah, out of 120, I was a good student.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite? What were your favorite subjects?
Well, to me, all of them were, because you couldn't bring anything below a C home, so you better love them all.
Oh, really? So your parents had a standard that?
Oh, you got that right.
Uh-huh.
You got that right. We had to, you don't bring you bring anything less than a C, you got to answer. Yeah, no, all the kids get together and study together, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was something that we wanted to do. My parents' goals was to be better than what they were. They all finished school, but they wanted you to be equal or better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I have the same standards, myself and my family, you know. So
right.
You got to go on. The only way you're going to succeed in life is to go to school.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you remember a favorite subject that you had? You said you liked all of them. But
math was a good subject for me, you know. Uh-huh. Because, you know, some of the things we did, and we believe we had algebra one, we had calculus, we had trigonometry, you know, and that was 11th and 12th grade, you know. So mm-hmm. It was something better than, you know, one basic math. Mm-hmm. You know, I never knew something, you know, those things existed until, you know, we actually mm-hmm. got to school and you start looking at numbers, you know, trigonometry, you know. it was something else.
Mm-hmm.
The slide ruler that we used then, you know, you don't hear today.
Right.
That they use calculators for, you know, Texas Instruments.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we use a slide ruler. It was a big difference. Yeah.
So what year did you graduate high school?
1964.
Okay. Let me ask you about growing up in the South. What kind of racial tensions did you witness, in the early 60s?
Really? Where we grew up, you got to remember, it's military where we was at. Everybody played and grew up together and eat together, you know. So,
that's right.
Yeah, so, you know, what was on the outside, you knew what your limitations were. You know where you didn't go, and you know you could read, you know, if it's in mm-hmm. black and white, mm-hmm. you go to the black side, you know. But basically, I've never experienced come up because we played together, we eat together, you know, we mm-hmm. lived in an environment. But, you know, when your military kids didn't play, kids like off-base schools, mm-hmm. the civilian schools, you didn't play this, you know, like a black school, you mm-hmm. know, or, you know, they just didn't do that, you know, you stay within your area, you know, you want to put it that way.
Right.
Yeah, and if military kids went downtown, which then Camp Sherwood was just a reserve base, but, you know, but the background, if you went to Germany, say, and came back to the States, you didn't go, you know, same places you would have went in Germany when you came back to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, or mm-hmm. Fort Benning, or something like that. You just didn't do that, you know. You knew where you was at.
Did your parents tell you kind of where to go, where not to go, or did you pick this up on your own?
You know wherever you were, you know. You mm-hmm. know, if you was in Chicago, you know you go anywhere you want. But mm-hmm. if you was down there, you know you red. You know, if you went to the bathroom, you go to the black bathroom.
Right.
You know, but if you was on the Camp Sherry, or you was at Fort Benning, or you was at one of their bases, you go anywhere you want on the base. But mm-hmm. when you stepped out that gate, it was a different story. So, you know, that's where it were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you stepped out of the gate and you...
When you went out downtown, it was all segregated, you know.
Right.
Like, this side you did this side you did that, you know, that's the way it was. And the biggest bad thing about it, like, if you was military and your best friend came, say, with you, say, overseas, and you came back to that one base,
mm-hmm.
then now you can't go downtown and have a burger or a hot dog together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get it and then eat walking down the street together with it, you know.
Meaning if you had a white friend that came to visit you.
Right, any kind of friend other than you, you know. You
right.
could be Mexican, Japanese, Chinese, you know, but now it's a different story. The two can't get along.
How did you feel about that? Do you remember as a young man?
We knew it wasn't fair, you know. We went to church. You couldn't even go to church together, you know, unless you go into the base and you go Protestant or Catholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you just can do all Baptist. You could go to a Protestant,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I went to churches with them, but you never was turned around. But, you know, you sit in the back with them. You didn't
mm-hmm.
go to the front, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you know, that's the way it was.
Do you think that, looking back at it today, do you think it had any kind of major psychological impact on you growing up? Or did it make you more determined to overcome that? Or did it really not affect you psychologically?
Be serious, truthfully with you, it didn't bother me at all because I knew, you know, when I grew up, like it was my father and all, times changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew from a kid, you know, every day changes. You know, my grandfather taught me that a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Two things my grandfather taught me. He said, time will change. What happened yesterday, don't worry about it. Tomorrow's what you got to worry about. And you only live day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but if you live long enough, you'll see things change. He told me from things that he did. My grandfather was a horse soldier, and he said all he did, believe it or not, he tied horses for the white officers when they came to their officers' club.
Hmm.
He shined their boots and shoed their horses.
Okay.
That's what he did. Now, he said, my father came in. My father said he'll never be a horse soldier, he'll never be boots. So he was a military policeman.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So when I came in the Air Force, my dad, he wanted me to go in the Army, but I came in the Air Force, and one of the things I told him, you know, I'd rather work 8 to 5 than work, you know, 7 days a week, get up early morning and night, because the Air Force basically work 8 to 5, you
mm-hmm.
know. That's what I thought, you know. But
right. Why did you join the Air Force exactly?
Because, believe it or not, I was walking down the street. I was out of school, and I was going to John Reese. He had a tech school, training school there. Mm-hmm. And I see these guys, and I knew that the draft and everything was going on, and I had to make a choice. Mm-hmm. And then I said, the guys in the blue, every weekend you see them down here, you know, from Myrtle Beach or mm-hmm. Charleston Air Force Base, Shaw Air Force Base. They'd be at the mall walking around, mm-hmm. civilian clothes. And the guys in the Army, they had to get a pass to go downtown, you know, walk around. But the Air Force had passes back then, but it was more like on weekends they was off. Mm-hmm. And the Army guys got that drilling or whatever. And I could see that when I go to bowling alley. My father, he worked on the weekends too. Mm-hmm. And like the Air Force was always off, it was so easy, you know. So mm-hmm. I said, hey, that's where I'm going. And that's where I went.
Now, did you think about going to college, or was it really the military that was attractive to you?
Really, when I got out of school?
Yes, sir.
I got out of school.
Okay.
But I could have went. My sisters and all brothers went, but I didn't. I was just tired at school. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just so many changes in schools. You know, mm-hmm. like I said. So when I got out, I went out.
Okay.
And, but like my father said, you go to work, you go to school, you got to do one of the two. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can't. Once you get out of school, you got to do something. You just can't sit here. You're not going to sit here. You know. Mm-hmm. And I knew that. Mm-hmm. So I tried tech school. You know, like I said, I went to John Reese. We did Brickland, Blockland. Really more like, it wasn't Peace Corps, but it was actually a school. You work 4 hours a day and they pay you 4 hours. Mm-hmm. But after that, I said, nah, got to be better than that. You know, in the summertime it was nice. In the wintertime it wasn't nice.
Right.
So I came in the Air Force. I came in the Air Force in July.
July 65?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me, first of all, was your father disappointed you chose the Air Force over the Army?
Oh, no. My father never disappointed any of his kids. He loved it. Okay. His kids' decisions, he always said, you make a decision, you live with them. If you think you want to do something, you're not sure, ask. He said, but if you got your mind made up, do it. He said, because if he made your mind up to do something and it went wrong, it's his decision, not yours.
Right.
He said, you make that decision, you make your own decision, you got to live with it.
Right. Okay.
So I made that decision on my own.
Okay. Well, tell me about when you joined the Air Force. What was it like?
Well, it was complete difference. When I joined the Air Force, it was from Fort Jackson, where we took our physical, mm-hmm. to Texas, and basic training. It was easier than I thought it was.
Your basic was at Lackland Air Force Base?
It was at Lackland.
Okay. How long did it last?
It was, we did two phases. Phase one was at Lackland, and mm-hmm. phase two, because there's so many people going through, mm-hmm. was at, let me see, what was that? It was up the road, believe it or not. From Shepherd.
Okay.
We went to Shepherd for the last 2 weeks. So it was 4 weeks at Lackland and 2 weeks at Shepherd.
Okay. Well, how would you describe your basic training?
It was easy. It was easier than Boy Scout. It was a discipline, you know, but I had that discipline already. I knew how to follow directions. Mm-hmm. But the basic training on me was easy, you know.
Okay.
It was fun and it was easy.
Did you get along with everybody?
Sure did. You know, I knew how to get along with people.
So, right.
Yeah. I had no problems with people. You know.
What do you remember most when you think back about your basic training? What comes to mind?
Most, when I came through, you know, we came through with a lot of different people, you know, got to mix the groups together. Mm-hmm. It was high, different people, it affects, you know, when people are told what to do, you mm-hmm. know. And some people couldn't accept people telling them what to do, things that they didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's people that wasn't used to climbing ropes or jumping in muddy, dirty water, get dirty and playing it, you know. Mm-hmm. I can remember those days, all the guys, you know. But believe it or not, we had everybody in my class went through. So,
how did you react to that new military discipline?
It didn't bother. I knew what it were. I you know, watched my dad at Fort Jackson. You know, all the different drill sergeants. We used to go out on the weekends and watch them. You know, mm-hmm. I knew. I expected more. You know, like what the Army did, but the Air Force didn't go to the extreme.
So you kind of had an advantage over these guys where you had been exposed to it all your life.
Yeah, see, I went in with a bunch of other guys that fathers was in the Army and military, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, we was like, you know, piece of cake, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How would you rate the leadership and the training that you received in basic?
It's good. It was good, really good. The leadership was good. It was there for you. The mm-hmm. management, the programs at that time and day, it was really good. You know, I can't complain about it.
Okay. Did your instructors, had they been in Southeast Asia at all that you were aware of?
Not at that time. No, okay. I know. Master Sergeant Campbell, I can remember his name. He has not. In fact, he was getting ready to retire, and the tech sergeant that came in right after him was there, and he was about ready to go. So okay. They had not been. And that day and time, a guy could go 30, and those guys just had been about 30 years in the military. It mm-hmm. wasn't then. There was a limit. You could go 30, and you could be anything. Mm-hmm. You could be, I think most you had to be at least a staff sergeant, you know. But, no, those guys had not been. And that was 65, so they would have had to be the first phase. It was only like 1,000 people when they first went into Vietnam. My father was over there when that first 1,000 people was over.
What did he do in Vietnam?
Military police.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what did you want to do in the Air Force? Did you want to fly? Or
you got that right. I wanted to fly, and guess what I did? I was a crew chief.
Okay.
I thought really when I came in that if you wanted to fly, they'd teach you how to fly the airplane. I didn't have no idea that you had to have a college degree to fly.
Okay.
But they fixed me right up. I had mechanical skills, so I could work on cars. I could do everything. My dad taught us how to take care of all that stuff. So.
Okay.
Mechanical skills helped me out on the tests and everything. You had to take a test to be, you know, you had to have a high school. And I had one of the high schools there were, mm-hmm. and they put me right into what I wanted. They put me not instead of flying, they made me a flying crew chief.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you left basic, phase one is at Lackland at Shepherd. What was different in phase two at Shepherd?
Really, it was just school. School, we had the phase two, we finished up, you know, your drills mm-hmm. and your other things that you didn't finish that they were pushing so many people through. Mm-hmm. You finish up at the first 3 weeks you get through that, you're gone. Mm-hmm. It was just really getting ready, really, for school.
Okay, so it was a lot of classroom?
A lot of classroom study.
Okay. What kind of weapons training did you receive?
Back then it was the M1. Mm-hmm. M1.
How were you with the weapon?
I could shoot guns. I hunt and fish. My father taught us all to hunt and fish. It was no problem. In fact, I actually got my expert ribbon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you go for your advanced training, the tech school?
I stayed right at Shepherd.
Stayed at Shepherd.
You stayed at Shepherd.
Okay, and this was, again, still in 1965, right?
66.
This is in 66.
No, 65, I'm sorry, September 65.
Okay. Tell me about the tech school at Shepherd. What was that advanced training like?
Okay, first we went into there, we went in there on fighters. There,
okay.
And then they said they had too many students. So they took us out of there. That was like 3 days. They took us out and put us on C-130s. They said, we need 130 troopers. So they put us on jet engine over 2. So we went to school from September to December.
Okay.
Yeah.
Learning the C-130?
Learning the basic jet over 2, and the C-130 was primary aircraft back then, turboprops reception.
Okay.
But that's what it was all about.
Okay. How did you take to the training? Was it easy for you to learn about the engines and the plane? Or?
Yeah, it was easy because the good thing was it was taught, believe it or not, properly. But it was about like an 8th grade education.
Really?
So it was, yeah, because they taught it simple enough so you could pick it up and understand it and do it. But, you know, with the least amount of training, because once you left there, you went to another, when you got to your base, you had to go to an FTD, which is Field Training Division Detachment. Mm-hmm. And then you had to go there like 30 days before you actually go to the aircraft you're actually going to work on.
Okay, so this was after tech school. You would go for those 3 weeks and then
right.
you would go?
Okay. Right.
How long did the tech school last at Shepherd?
Went to December the 18th.
Oh, okay.
That's when I got out of tech school.
All right, and when you got out, you knew exactly which aircraft you're going to and where
yes.
you would be going?
Yes.
Okay. So what did you think? Tell me about the C-130. What did you think of it as an aircraft?
I think it's the best aircraft in the world.
Why?
Because I've seen things on that aircraft do that I've never seen anything else do. You know, I went through that aircraft with this. When I see it come home with one engine,
okay.
I see it with steel bows in the wings, you know.
Wow.
I see half the wheel wells blowed off, you know, the nose shot off. I've just seen too much,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the C-130 would do. I see it get you out of areas where you thought you weren't going to make it, and you look up and you see nothing but blue sky above.
Mm-hmm.
I just see too much, you know. So
okay.
I think it's the best aircraft in the world.
Okay. Okay. We can talk about some of those experiences later
yeah.
about in Southeast Asia. Now, had you flown yet, actually been in the aircraft and flown, or not?
When I got to January, I went from tech school mm-hmm. home 2 weeks, and then I went to Japan. My first military assignment in January of 66.
Okay.
And then I got my first flight in January of 66.
Tell me about the first flight.
First flight, you know, I was used to flying, you know, so the first flight in the C-130,
mm-hmm.
it was an assault takeoff. You know, they had all the basic guys, the new guys, they always give you an orientation flight.
Mm-hmm.
That aircraft was something else. It wasn't like the old C-121s, the recepts and the C-54s, you know, the old, you know, airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It took off. It was just, was a ride, you know, just to take off in it, you know.
Right.
There's so much more expected, you know. We went to school on them, you know, you see pictures on them, but to actually see it do it, and mm-hmm. it did everything it said it would do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was something else.
What were your...
It was loud.
Oh, really?
It's loud and shaky. It had three propellers on the old A-Mala.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something else. It would fly to take off in a football field. It was a good airplane.
What were your specific duties in Japan?
I was crew chief.
You were the crew chief?
Yes.
And what were you, so explain to me what your crew chief duties were.
My crew chief duties, I was a crew chief. I was responsible for keeping that baby flying. I pre-flighted, I post-flighted. When I said pre-flighted, that's before you get ready to fly every day. You come out 4 hours before flight time. You check the aircraft over.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure it's got fuel on it, the oil. You check radios, you check air pressures, hydraulic pressure, your oxygen. You did everything. You just got it ready for full flight. You check every system. As a crew chief, you were responsible for knowing every system on the aircraft.
Okay.
Okay, so that's what you done.
How hard was it for you to know every system?
It took time, mm-hmm. but as times went, I had a good supervisor. Where I said the crew chief, I was an assistant, but I was in the 3 level.
Mm-hmm.
And out of tech school, and what tech school taught us, it helped us. And then from there, we went like a week. We actually went to the aircraft, and then we went to the FTD.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was 2 weeks, and then back out to the aircraft, and then you was basically working. And then you was doing your CDCs, which was book learning, you know, your knowledge from mm-hmm. books to upgrade to follow.
Mm-hmm.
But it was easy to learn. You know, if you want to learn something, it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to learn it. I wanted to be the best. My,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was something that I wanted to do.
Okay. Were you in charge of the other men on the aircraft as far as the crew? Not the pilot and the co-pilot.
No. I was one of five. I was like one stripe, and the boss was a tech sergeant. He had five, so he was in charge.
Okay.
I was working for him.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I was about 5 years later, I was at my own aircraft.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long were you in Japan?
I was in Japan the first time 2 years.
For 2 years to 1968?
Yeah.
Okay, and during this time, is that when you first went into Southeast Asia, into Vietnam?
Yeah, that's when I all classified. 1966 to 1968 is totally classified what I done.
Okay, so you can't talk about where you went or what you did?
I can tell you areas, but I cannot tell you what I done.
Okay, tell me as much as you can about it.
When I went to Southeast Asia, all my missions was classified. We went to Laos, Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Every country over there, they said we was and we went.
Okay.
And as a crew chief. And,
okay.
That's, you know, we didn't land. We flew in and we flew out. So
okay.
I was in a reconnaissance squadron.
Okay.
That's what I can tell you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell me your general impressions of Southeast Asia, kind of physically what it looked like? What did you think of the countries?
Okay. Now, when I did land, all our mission was in recon. The trash haul missions, as we trash haul trainers,
mm-hmm.
When I first went over there, I lived in a chicken coop. Not a chicken coop, a 20-man tent.
No, you can't tell me where, but...
I can tell you. I can tell you the location there where we land. Yes.
Okay. Where?
My first assignment was there. Was in. Let's see. Was the name? No. It wasn't. Let me think of it quick. So we went from Cameron Bay.
Mhm.
Yeah. Well, Cameron Bay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how long were you there, Cameron?
We were there off and on. You know.
Okay.
Through that time frame, we stayed there. You know, to go in and out. And we lived in 20-man tents in Cameron Bay.
Okay.
And the 20-man tents, when it rained, it fell in on you.
Oh, really?
You used steel lockers, the wall lockers, to put them in the corners and one in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So when it rained, the monsoon season comes to get out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then from the tents, we went to chicken coops.
What do you mean by chicken coop?
They had, they're like a chicken coop, wood on the bottom, wire all the way around, stream all around the top.
Hmm.
The bottom, but up to about 6 foot, it was wood, like plywood all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And the top had chicken wire.
Okay.
And then the top, you know, had 10, you know, 10 roofs.
Mm-hmm. How many men in one of these?
Oh, Lord have mercy. They had, I tell you what, they was about the length of a foot, not a foot, half of a foot, about 50 yards long.
Okay.
And they was it was a bunch of them. I can't give you the right numbers,
mm-hmm.
but there was that many. And you only had about, 10 foot to yourself.
Okay.
And it was aisle down the middle, and then you got another people on the other side of you there. So it was a bunch of people in those units.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. And how long would you stay there at this place before you take back off for another mission?
Oh, we so if we did that, we would stay a day or two.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you take back off, and you come back, and you're so you're based out of Cameron the first time?
Cameron.
Okay. Yeah. And other places, where other during this 2 year period, where else were you based out of in South Vietnam?
Da Nang.
At Da Nang?
Yeah.
What were those quarters like? What was base life like?
Basically, they all was the same during those time frames.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They all came up together. They cut off from tents and to chicken coops, as I call them.
Okay.
Tents to chicken coops.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me as much as you can about what was a typical day like for you? I know you can't describe the mission.
Oh, the day was for 12-hour days. Mm-hmm. That's basically what they were, you know.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Sure. Again.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
The day was basically a 10-hour flight day.
Okay.
4 hours before flight and 4 hours after flight.
Okay.
That's what the day was. You know, the pre-flight was 4 hours, that's before flight. Fly 10, come home, 4 hours, get the aircraft ready to go back the next day or two.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was the C-130 very, you've described it being very durable, but when you would service the aircraft, was there any particular thing that you would see that the C-130s did have wrong with it, or was it a variety of things?
No, it was a good aircraft. You know, you had to do preventive maintenance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had good aircraft. They was taken care of. We had to get people to work on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, you know, if things you know, went wrong, it was like, you know, we changed things. It was like, life, you know, the life of an item or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing really, to me, wrong with the aircraft. Like I said, I enjoyed it, you know. So,
okay.
Yeah. You know, you had to, if you fly, you had to put gas in it. You had to check the engine for oil, mm-hmm. Hydraulic fluids, you know, you had to serve oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did. Yeah, that's just stuff you had to do when it came back. I mean, mm-hmm. you use it, you know.
What kind of relationship did you have with the crew, the rest of the crew and the pilots and co-pilot?
Oh, you live with those. Those are just like your brothers over there. You know,
uh-huh.
we didn't have young ladies in the aircraft at the time.
Uh-huh.
But you live with those guys. Those guys was you and them. Everything you did it together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Eat together.
Did you form any special relationships with these men? Good friendships?
Oh, yeah. You was all good friends. Like I said, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're all good friends.
Have you kept in touch with any of them?
Yeah, I talked to all but one guy I can't find. And I don't know what happened to him. But
mm-hmm.
I can talk to any of them anytime.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you first experience combat? Can you talk about that? Was it ground fire? Was it mortar attack on the base?
Well, the first time we got hit was in a mortar fire in the afternoon, and we stayed all night in a ditch in front of base ops.
Okay. This was at Da Nang or
yeah.
Cameron?
Let me think something here.
Okay.
We first went there. Let me get a book. I got a book.
Okay,
with it. I got
sure.
Just 1 minute.
Okay, let me take a break. Okay, you said I was asking you about Cameron or Da Nang. And the.
Okay, first time I was over there, by the way, it was in Da Nang.
Okay, at
there you go. I had my mind was wobbling there. The first time I went there was in Da Nang. We moved from Da Nang to Cameron Bay.
Okay.
So when you said first time we got hit was I spent a ditch in the Da Nang.
Okay.
And it was in a ditch in front of base ops. It was a mortar attack.
Okay. Well, how did you feel during this attack? This is your first time in combat.
It was surprising. It was louder than those cannons I hear at Fort Jackson.
Uh-huh.
It's the first time.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's something you'll always remember. That's why when you said that, I thought about that. No, that was the wrong place, I told you.
Uh-huh.
I knew exactly. It was at Da Nang in front of base ops.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was a mortar attack. Right, soon after the sun started going out.
Okay.
How
many times did you receive mortar fire at Da Nang and Cameron?
It was a while. Oh, you talking about like how many times
yeah.
I was there?
The frequency of it.
Oh, sometimes you could go weeks without it. Then sometimes it hits 2 or 3 times a week.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know.
Did you get used to it, or was it?
No, you never get used to it. You never get woke up. They always do it at night. You never get used to it.
Uh-huh.
You forget that.
Uh-huh.
And we live, unfortunately, the aircraft and the crews lived way on the other end from the fuel pits, you know.
Okay.
So that's what they always tried to hit.
The fuel supply.
Yeah. So what we did, our aircraft, we would park, and we would always keep one person by the aircraft.
Okay.
And so when the base got hit, in fact, wasn't that, right, we got hit. The first one to get on aircraft, get on aircraft and start engines up. Uh-huh. And the rest of the crew get out there in a Jeep and you get to try to get those aircraft out of there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was your prime responsibility when you came under fire?
If the first person got there, if okay. I was the first person, I had to get in there and get those aircraft engines rolling.
Okay.
And then the rest of them come up and take it off, minimum crew, whatever it takes to get out of there.
To protect the aircraft?
Yeah.
Okay. How many times did you do that? Was that every time or not?
No, I don't know how many times, you know, but I have did that, you know.
That was standard?
I can't say how many times.
Okay. Yeah. But that was standard procedure?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about, like you said, you would go in country for 22 days and then go back to Japan, or tell me how that worked.
Go back to Japan 8 days.
Okay.
That's when you go back, if you do your post-flight, I mean your face-to-face, you know, check your engines, you do your inspections, you do all kind of stuff like that.
Back in Japan.
Right.
Okay. Then you go back in country for 22 days.
Go back in country for 22 days.
Okay, and you did this off and on for 2 years.
2 years.
Okay, all right. Can you describe at all any of the tactics you guys used in the field when you were actually flying, you know, avoiding fire or coming into landing zones or anything like that? Can you talk about?
No.
Okay.
Can't do that.
Okay. No. Were you ever wounded during this tour?
No.
Were you ever wounded during any of your time in country?
No.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a little bit about your impressions of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. What did you think of the countries themselves physically? What was your first impression?
It's nasty.
Why?
It smell.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. The beaches, let me tell you something. The beaches was nice. It was one of the best beaches in the world. White, clean, pretty.
Uh-huh.
You can walk out in the water and see your feet, you know.
Uh-huh.
The country, it's, you know, you got to remember the age. They didn't have sewage, you know, and the Benjo ditches. Well, I call them Benjo ditches because that's what they call them in Japan. But the ditches, the bathrooms and stuff run into ditches, and the ditches run off somewhere else, but it smell.
Mm-hmm.
And the food, I personally have never eaten off the insulation, so I couldn't tell you how the food was off. But I didn't like the way it looked. And those eggs they bury in the ground, balooks that they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would eat, you know, they also eat those big water bugs they call them. We call them roaches.
Uh-huh.
They eat all that stuff, you know. That was something above me.
Okay.
And so I never eaten off any food off the base. I don't drink or smoke, so I just couldn't, you know. I came in the country to do a mission and get home as fast as possible.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, how did you feel being in a war zone?
I didn't really. It didn't cross your mind because you were young, you know, you trying to, you know, it was a new experience. And I was just, you know, I've been on an aircraft that been shot at, so I knew what that sound was.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, I never really understood the war, but I knew we was there for a reason.
What did they tell you, or what did you understand at the time, why the United States? I'm sorry?
The briefings we was in, to try to help the people to become their own, you know, become a democratic government.
Okay.
So to try to help them get out of communism.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what we was told. How
did you feel about that reason for being in there?
I didn't question it, you know.
Okay.
I just did what I thought was right, you know. That's what the people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of things cross your mind, you know. You was helping those people, but, you know, people like back in the South, back in the States, they had some of the same problems, you know, and you wasn't doing anything there, you know, so.
Can you explain that? What do you mean by that?
But, you know, like segregation and
yes.
stuff like that, the people, you know, the people, that poor people that walk in the streets, I don't, you know, didn't have food, you know, the people like pushing grocery carts, you know, from store to store, no place to live.
Mm-hmm.
GIs that had been there and came back home, you know, looking for jobs, couldn't find jobs. But we was over there trying to help those people. We weren't helping ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but really, you know, that crossed the mind, you know, which is natural. But to do a job over there, what we was doing, I wanted to do the best job I could do.
Okay. Did you guys talk about it in your unit a lot?
Oh, no, you didn't ever talk about nothing like that, you know.
Okay.
Basic, when you was there, You just hope to, you know, you take off and get back home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How was morale?
Oh, it was good. You know, you didn't have to worry about that. Everybody,
okay.
you know, it was togetherness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, we wouldn't be. I can pick up the phone, call anyone now if I wanted to, you know. So that's just something, you know. All one person I can't find. So.
Okay.
And you know, we stuck together as a unit, not as just aircraft, the whole squadron, you know. We was a squadron, one of two in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew them as well as they knew us. You know, we was a small. We never talked to the rest of the base. You know, we was all together.
Because of your classified status?
Right, right. We didn't talk to anyone else.
Okay.
People didn't talk to us. They didn't understand us, but we wasn't. We just didn't do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you kind of kept to yourself.
We kept to ourselves.
Okay. Yeah. Can you talk about your impression of the Vietnamese civilians or the Lao, the Cambodian civilians?
We didn't get in touch with them, remember?
Okay.
We didn't touch. We see them. You know, we was at. We had our own compound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you didn't have a lot of contact with them?
None. The only time we were there, well, we walked, speak to them, you know, we passed by going to eat or something like that, mm-hmm. you know. But for us to sit down and talk to them, no.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the enemy, of the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and other enemy forces? What was your general impression?
To me, the ones that, you know, if I had to make an impression of,
mm-hmm.
they was trying to survive. They was trying to get something that they didn't have. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's what I. It's just like they wanted something that someone else had,
mm-hmm.
and to me that what I was told that they wanted that country back as one, and what I really believe mm-hmm. they just wanted to expand to have be bigger. You know,
okay.
It wasn't that they just wanted the country; they just wanted to be expand to be bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And if they got that's they had rice and rubber over there, so I figured they might have needed that there. Feed the people, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one time I thought it was like they told us one time it was just two like a big family fuse, you know. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you shoot mortars and hit your family, you know. So
mm-hmm.
to me, I think it was all about expansion, you know, who controlled
okay.
who.
Okay.
Yeah.
What would you say were the strengths and weaknesses of the enemy on the ground?
The biggest weakness that owned Ben on the ground, the strength, is they knew where we were. We didn't know where they was at because they could. All we knew was Vietnamese. You
mm-hmm.
didn't know north from the south.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can remember on the outside of the compound, when you see any of them on the base during the daytime,
mm-hmm.
you better hide at night. That was the story that they told me that was true throughout my times over there. They wouldn't come to work today. Most of the time, majority, put it that way, would not show up the nights we got hit by mortar attack.
Hmm.
So
they knew something that you
they
didn't.
Knew something before we did, and all you had to do is wake up and open your eyes and see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to me, we was helping somebody that really didn't want to be helped. I think they wanted the money, you know, because we spent a lot of money over there.
Mm-hmm.
And we helped them a lot, but the people now, you had some true ones over there that really fought for what they believed in. They wanted to overturn it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it was the majority of those people.
Did you have any contact with the South Vietnamese armed forces, the ones that were supposed to be our allies?
No more than, you know, if we went downtown, you know, they would, like, we go off as a crew.
Mm-hmm.
We went off to the beaches and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We sit, you know, patrolling the roads. But, we speak to them. Like I said, we don't talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And I want to ask you some general questions about your time, your recreation, things like that. But let's go ahead and get down on record the times you were there. After 1968, did you go back to the United States?
Went back to the United States from 68 to 69.
Okay.
And went back to, it was Seward Air Force Base, Tennessee. It was C-130 crew chief again.
Okay, so you did more training or you were just based
just
there?
Reassigned.
Okay, just reassigned to Seward.
Right.
Okay, and then in 69, where did you go from
went
there?
Went back to Tachikawa Air Force Base, Japan. Stage out of there, back to Vietnam.
So the same mission?
No, that was a trash haul mission. That was a trash haul.
This the second time around?
Right, the second time around.
And how long was this tour?
That was there. I was at Tachikawa to close. That was from May to November.
In 69?
69.
Okay. And when it closed in November,
I went back over to Yokota in the same classified unit.
Okay, so the 69 tour was at Tachikawa.
Right.
Okay, and the first one was at Yokota.
Yokota, right.
Okay. Okay, so in November 69, you go back to Yokota and you get back on this classified
right.
mission. Okay, and how long were you on this mission?
April 72.
Okay, so that's a pretty long time there.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you feel being away from the United States for so long?
It was quick, believe it or not.
Really?
It was quick. Time was quick because you were so gone so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could tell you a little story. I was gone so much, 6 months I didn't cash a check.
Really?
And the first shirt came, they sent a letter to me, to my supervisor. They wanted to talk to me. They thought I was dead. Because, you know, then they would send you checks in the mail.
Uh-huh.
And I would always come back. I was taking them to have my friends pick my mail up and just throw it in my wall locker. And we had these steel lockers with the hole. They would just throw them up there.
Mm-hmm.
They thought I was dead or something. So I had to go get those checks out. But the first shirt came to the barracks. I get them all out, go put them in the bank.
Now, why didn't you cash your checks?
Because it didn't have no reason to cash them. Because, you know, you had TDY money, Padel money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just take that money and live on it, you know. Because it really didn't cost so much to live, you know, and eat. WREs, as they call them, you know,
mm-hmm.
a meal ready to eat, you know, they call now. But we eat those box lunches, most of the time flight lunches and stuff, you know. So
you had no reason to really spend your own money.
No, I didn't drink, didn't smoke, and didn't go down on the town and waste my money down there, you know.
Okay.
So that's a little story I still live with and tell my kids about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they just like I said, you know, to me the time went fast. It really did.
Okay. Did you have a lot of contact with your family and your parents back home?
Oh, yeah. I call them, I write. They write me, sisters and brothers, grandmamas and granddaddies, aunts
uh-huh.
and all, because they was concerned, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because at that time, everybody was afraid. If you went to Vietnam, you're going to come back in a box.
Right.
You know? And especially as we came back the first time and went back the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, you know. You just don't make it two times.
Right.
Yeah, you know? But I did three times.
So they supported what you were doing?
Oh, yeah. Even if they didn't, they would have never told me.
Okay.
So, okay.
Did you talk about the danger that you were in over there flying?
Oh, no. I tell them I was flying.
Right.
You know, and, you know, they'd get the letters. You know, in your mail over there, you didn't have to put stamps in letters. I went right from over there, right from, you know, dropping any mailbox I passed by,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, they knew where I was at. I didn't have to just tell them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your tour at Tachikawa from May 69 to November 69, trash hauling. Tell me about that. What did you do?
Basically, when you said trash hauling, I was on an old A-Mauler.
Uh-huh.
We go in there and we pick up whatever they had to carry.
Uh-huh.
We went in there. We was at 834th Air Division.
Uh-huh.
And whatever they had, we was out of Tunsanoot.
Uh-huh.
That's where we staged out of. That was a good old capital. We staged out of there. We lived only in chicken coops at that time. It was up to date.
Now, tell me about Tonsonet. Was it much, much bigger than Cameron?
Oh, it was bigger. It was bigger, but less beaches.
Okay.
It was bigger. That's the way everybody came into. It was bigger, but we still, like I said, you was there with everybody that came from Philippines,
mm-hmm.
Taiwan. Everybody that came over there was part of the 834th Air Division.
Mm-hmm.
And then, every kind of aircraft in the world was old E-models, B-models, and we had the old E-models. We had the oldest thing out there.
Mm-hmm.
They always gave us the dirt missions or assault missions to go in and get people or whatever, pick up bodies, take mail, anything they need to be done. And that's why you said trash hauls.
Tell me, describe what some of those loads you would carry. You said picking up bodies sometimes. What was that like?
It was a hurting feeling because, you know, it was a fallen Army, you know, American, whatever. Could be Australian, Korean, or whatever. It hurt, you know, to know
mm-hmm.
somebody died, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You carry their body back to the Philippines, Japan, and from there they fly them to Hawaii, back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts, you know. And I only seen one body that I actually looked at, and I seen it was from, believe it or not, it was from home, you know, and I said, oh, Lord, you know, but, you know, I can tell you when they went from green bags to clear bags back to green bags, you know, it bothers, you know, there's no some kids so young,
mm-hmm.
you know, your age are dying,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
The clear bags were much worse to have on board.
Yeah, and I went in and picked up bodies, I don't know if I tell you, I can tell you, I went in and picked up bodies. And it'd be so many when you get into the aircraft revetments, you take the fire trucks and meet you there to wash the aircraft out, you know, if you're so bloody.
Wow.
You know, so those are the kind of experiences you picked up in Tachikawa. And then the good ones was when you take out the meals or food and stuff to the Army and you drop it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they drop the mail or the Stars and Stripes book, you know, magazine,
mm-hmm.
the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good days, you know. You pick up a troop that, you know, is wounded and get them to the hospital, you know. Those are good days. But the bad days, like I said, is the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst days is when you take a Korean body. You know, they don't cremate those. They pack them in sand, wet sand, put them in wooden boxes, mm-hmm. and fly those home. Those is the worst days.
Why is that?
The smell.
Really?
Yeah, they smell bad. In fact, it's some of the worst smells you can smell. And some of the glorious days, like I said, was when you're helping somebody on. And the in-between days is when you pick up a Vietnamese general mm-hmm. and his whole family and his sheep, his cows, his pigs, or whatever he got, and take them from one place to the other.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So you hauled everything.
That's why I call them trash haul days.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What was it like carrying wounded Americans? Did you talk with them?
Oh, yeah. Talk with them, help them out, you know, mm-hmm. load them on the ambulance, do everything you can, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah.
What'd you say to them?
Well, you anything he want to talk about, everything, but don't ask about, you know, the pain. You
right.
know? Just try to help him out, you know. We'll be there soon, you know. If you need anything, holler, you know, or raise your hand if you can holler, you know, simple thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't mention anything about home. You know, mention anything he don't want to talk about.
Right.
Know? Try to keep that spirit up.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's basically what you talk about.
Okay. Mm-hmm. During this this tour or this brief time trash hauling, how often were you shot at?
We take it off and landing.
Almost every time?
About, I would say every other.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's where we got the experience with a bow and arrow through the wing.
What happened there?
Somebody shot a, you know, a crossbow, I guess, uh-huh. through the wing of a C-130. Yeah.
Your C-130?
No, one in front of us.
Okay.
You got aircraft landing all the time, boom, boom, boom. And then he landed, and we see these sparks coming off the runway.
Mm-hmm.
And you look up there, and it was crossbow through the wing.
Hmm.
And then the worst thing that ever happened to me on a trash hauler was to land with two engines.
With two engines?
Yeah, but I have seen one land with one, but we landed with two.
What happened on that flight?
The engines shot out.
Okay.
You know, so we shut them down and try to crank them up. Shut them down in flight, try to crank them up before you land. They don't crank back up.
Uh-huh.
So you land with two. So, you know what I was thinking about? I already had put my chute on and my butt pad and everything. I ready to jump. But like I said, they're the best aircraft I ever rode on.
Right.
I believe in them, and mm-hmm. I've seen them do things that other aircraft probably couldn't.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things are you talking about?
Like laying in a football field.
Uh-huh.
Go in and pick up a wounded troop with the engines running. Back all the way up first you can into the trees, the tail bent over trees, load bodies in, and take off. Never shut the engine down.
Uh-huh.
Let the ramp down and run them in there and take off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never stop running, you know. That's something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
How would you approach a landing zone? Was there a particular way you would go in and come out?
We'd go in any way you could get it in there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you just say, hold on, strap down, and get ready.
Uh-huh.
And when they said, when you feel it going, you can feel it, you know, if you've flown a while, you know when you're ready to hit the ground.
Uh-huh.
And that's dirt you're talking about.
Right.
Not a runway.
Right.
You can feel it as you get close to the ground. And when you hit the ground, you better be strapped down and holding on, because when you hit the ground going forward, you stop all of a sudden and the aircraft start backing up.
Uh-huh.
And then when she stopped, doors are open, bodies are running in, and then when that door, before the door is closed all the way, you're going forward.
Huh.
So you know to hold on.
Did you help load and unload?
Oh, you got that right. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Every available hand that could help.
Okay.
Only two people that wasn't doing anything was the people in the cockpit. They never leave. The
right.
load masters, the crew chief, the engineer, the pilots, and now we got to stay there front.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And everybody else pitched in.
Everybody else pitched in. So, I mean, the load masters and the crew chief gets to know everything. They get to work together hand in hand. You had two load masters and one crew chief in the back.
Mm-hmm.
One crew chief always flew with aircraft.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of weapons did you carry? Were you armed?
We had gun boxes on the aircraft. Shotgun. The pilots had 38s or 45 during that time frame. I think it was 38s. They had the small handle, like we call Lady Griff 38s.
Mm-hmm.
They had those. And the butt pass, you know, all had 22s. But what we had on the gun box was shotguns and OM-1 carbons.
Mm-hmm.
And later on they had M2s, but I don't know if, you know, during that time frame it was M2s, but I know it was either M1s, M2s.
Did you ever have to use them?
Well, yes and no.
Can't talk about that?
Or? I don't like to, yeah, but
okay.
Do what you had to do. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And so when you went back to your classified mission at Yokota, and you went until 1972, in 72 did you go back to the States or transfer?
Go back to the States. Go back to Pease Air Force Base.
To Pease. How long were you there?
I was there to November 73.
Okay. And then?
Back to 130s in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Okay. And how long were you there in Little Rock?
To 75. That's when I went back to the Philippines.
Okay, you went back to the Philippines.
Yeah.
And I assume by this time you had decided to make the Air Force your career?
You got that right. After for my first 3 years and 9 months or so, I had a job for Hercules Power Company.
Uh-huh.
It was at Hercules, big old plant.
Uh-huh.
Just about the time I got ready to get out, that was in Tennessee, they called and told me they were laying off people with 10 years to be working, and I probably wouldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, forget this. I just stay in. I stayed in. And then I told my father, if I've been in over 16 more to go, I'm going to stay where I'm at.
Right.
And
to get to 20 years.
You got that right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's what I done.
Do you think that was a good decision looking back on it now?
Oh, I know it was.
Okay.
I know it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you went back to the Philippines, what did you do? Did you fly in and out of...
We went back over there to help them doing Operation Baby Lift, and they was evacuating Vietnam. That's where I went back from there.
They deployed
into the Philippines, TDY, and become PCS. I was there 22 months.
22 months.
Yeah.
Okay, to 77.
Yeah.
Tell me about Operation Baby Lift. What was that like, getting people out of the country?
Scary.
How so?
Because you didn't know if you were going to make it or not. You've seen all those Vietnamese. I ain't never seen that many people run before in my life. I thought it was Chinese trying to run and overtake, the bases. Because then we was really trying to get everybody that we could get out. We was evacuation,
Did you go to Thompson Nut mainly, or did you go all over the country?
Anywhere they needed to get an aircraft in to get people out.
Okay.
We was just getting the people out. So we flew a lot of places. Pleiku, Da Nang, you name it. We went in and we got them out. Wherever the ops said, get them out.
Where were you based in country at Thompson Nut, or?
No. We flew out of the Philippines.
Every time out of the Philippines.
Yeah, which is skipping a hop in, from
over
there. Yeah.
Right.
Flew in the, once you take off, you had to go drop and then fuel up, go back. We had 2 or 3 missions a day sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had contact with these Vietnamese civilians, getting them out of there.
Yeah. You didn't know which ones to trust, though. But Da Nang, I had a bad experience. I didn't tell you about that one. The guy get on aircraft with a grenade, get off, and they leave a grenade in the seat.
He left a grenade in the seat.
Yeah.
Was it pin pulled?
It was a watch trigger. So if you let the seats flip up.
Yes.
If you let the seat flip up, it'll pop. It'll pull the pin out. So the pin wasn't pulled, but if you pull the seat up, it would have been pulled.
Now, how did you guys see that, and what did
when
you do
you're doing your inspection in your dual rails, you always look and be sure there's nothing hung up in there. You look up in there and see the wire, and you knew already. You see, it was laying down the seat. So if you'd have picked it up, you'd have pulled it. If you let the seat up, it'd have pulled it. So when you look up in there and see a copper wire, you're told what to look for in school. You learn after time. So the older guys will teach you. And you learn. And then when you look and see the wire, you just back up. Take a good pitch, and then go from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other experiences with the civilians flying? What was it like did you converse with them? Did you talk? Did you communicate with them?
When we load, I stood up on Buck 245 right next to the buckhead. I had a jump seat up there with a 12-gauge shotgun doorbell.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that all of them really wanted to come home. That was my job, 12-gauge shotgun.
Did you ever have any trouble?
No. No, they was ready to get out of there as fast as we were.
Right.
Yeah, but you never knew, you know what I mean?
So they had warned you, basically, be ready for anything.
Yep, they didn't, not to go up on the flight deck. Keep them off the deck, whatever it took.
Okay, but you had no trouble? Nobody ever tried
nobody,
to get
nobody had any trouble that I knew of. The only trouble we had was when that C-5 went down with all those kids.
Right.
That wasn't ours. That was someone else's. We was up on the other parallel, northern parallel, when that happened. Yeah.
How'd you feel about that when it happened?
It's a feeling that you don't want to ever experience. It hurts all kids like that. Big old aircraft, you figure you get every one of those loads out, you got a bunch. That's 10 loads you don't have to go in and get. And then just to see kids' life go like that, when you just took them out of, trying to get them back to freedom, and you see something like that, you don't ever forget that.
Right.
Never.
You didn't see it actually happen.
We was up on the other end. We flew over after it happened. But you don't want to forget nothing like that.
Did you ever have any close calls during this mission of evacuation?
Believe it or not, none.
Really?
Not even shot at.
Really?
No, none.
Hmm.
Nope, none. Just in and out.
Right.
Yeah.
What is your impression of the Vietnamese? You know, when you would look at them on the plane, were they relieved? Were they scared? What are they,
all hugged up. We run them in standing up, and they all sit down together, stand up together. You got as many as you could on the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were you talking to like maybe 50 people or 100?
More than that, hundreds.
Hundreds.
Not, I would say 200, but more than 100. You run them in, all standing with their families and babies, and when they all stand up, then you tell them all sit down, you run a tie-down seat, you couldn't sit down in seats, and whatever they had in their hand, babies or whatever, you run a tie-down strap, a strap across the back of the aircraft, and you, this is the evacuation, and you get them out of there.
Right.
You take it, you know, you pop it out. If you come, once you take off, somebody else coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on where you was landing, you know, you land on runways or, you know, taxiways or whatever, you mm-hmm. doing the best you can. You had jets out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't hold up. You got to get in and out.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the United States withdrawing out of Vietnam? I mean, you're actually evacuating the people, and the U.S. has already left, basically, in 73, but you're helping with the evacuation. How did you feel about all that?
Personally, I didn't think we would ever run out of a place, you know.
I'm sorry, you didn't think?
Personally, I didn't think the U.S. would ever run out of a place.
Really?
You know, not us, you know.
Uh-huh.
I didn't think. I didn't understand that after we've been there so long, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all of what now we're leaving. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that. I really don't, even today I don't understand why we had to leave and run from a small country like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody never came on board and said, why? Did the Vietnamese still want to fight, or we just got tired of fighting, or I don't know.
What do you think about it today? Do you?
Well, at least the country went back together, and I see we put an embassy over there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I support the U.S. government. I fought this war, you know, 28 years I was in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to go back. Hey, you know, whatever the U.S. government do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I had to go back today and fight for this country, I guess I would, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what did you think of the American policy of turning the war over to the Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, to fight their own war? Did you think they were capable?
Nope. No, they wasn't.
Why not?
Because first thing, training. First thing, you didn't know who you was training.
Okay.
Third, when they got trained, they didn't, you know, most of them, okay, put it this way. You train one. You give them a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When the war, like mortar attacks and stuff like that, you never seen them. So you might have been training your own enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, like aircraft, we would give them aircraft. We, you know, when we came over there, we gave them 119s and stuff like that. They would never do anything, you
mm-hmm.
know? And firefights like that. They had the army, the ones that they put out front when they really got in the firefights, you never seen them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they was afraid of the majority or what, but when they was overran, they didn't stand up and fight. If they was stood up and fought, I don't think they would have been able to overrun them. It was as many South Vietnamese as North Vietnamese, where they had more weapons, they had, you know, better equipment. Why did they run? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So if they're weak and they don't fight for their own country, that says a lot to me, you know.
Was this a slow evolving opinion you had, or did you kind of see this from the very beginning?
When we went back over there in 75,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't understand. Why are you going to run? You got to tell them the best aircraft, you got the bases, you know, you got everything you want. You can fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got bases staged throughout. You got the Army, you got the Marines. When they pulling out, you know, and left them to do their own, it's because I think our government thought they could withhold their own. But I never thought from day one they could, you know, even when I was in Tachikawa or you're hauling bodies, you would see them always sitting down eating. You never seen them doing anything. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think they could do anything. Even when we put a guard dude on the ramp, they'd be yaggity-yak. We'd be standing up there on the flight line.
Really?
Yeah, you know.
So they were not really doing their jobs.
I don't think they paid close attention to detail.
Okay.
To the ones, that's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's why the country went the way it did, because we didn't really know who we was fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, we were fighting the North Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, it looked the same to me.
Right.
Yeah, so yeah. I think we was fighting a losing cause.
Did your fellow crew members think the same kind of thing? Were they witnessing the same thing you were?
I don't know. I never asked them. Like I said, that's my personal opinion.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like in 1975? Did you actually fly into Saigon in 75? Or into Tonsonut?
Went to Tonsonut. Went to Pleiku. We went to Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Went a lot of different places. Every little hole, they wanted to get bodies out, you know, get
right.
people out. But the majority of them really came out of Saigon.
What was the,
that's where the big boys was.
Right. what was it like there in Saigon in April
75? People running over people.
Really?
People running over people trying to get on those aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Fight it, you know, you name it. They were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the only thing that hurt the worst when you think about it is the people that wasn't accounted for our own POWs.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't account for them. And I do believe, this is me again,
mm-hmm.
that they some of those people had to know where they was at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they was really good people, South Vietnamese was really that good, they could have been the one to go into the north and find out where they was located at.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know one from the other anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They could have went over there and found out where they was at. Maybe we could have got some of our people out if they were in POW camps. But you never know. If you think about it, no Vietnamese ever came forward and told us where NL POWs was at.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what all I got to say.
Why do you think they didn't do that?
Because I don't think they want to. I think they was all out for themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you a little bit about, in general, when you were on the bases, you know, either at Thon Son Nhut or Cameron or Da Nang, what did you guys do for recreation and entertainment?
What we did for recreation?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we run. They had running tracks, you know, run. Mm-hmm. Just go out and run. You could play basketball. You could play volleyball. Mm-hmm. They had a service club. Believe it or not, they had slot machines, if I remember.
Really?
They had slot machine. They had pool tables. They had shutter boards.
Mm-hmm.
You know where you slide the little ball. They had everything.
Did you play the slots?
I don't play slots.
Okay. What were your favorite things to do?
My favorite thing was I played a lot of cards, you know, non-gambling, like Bidwest,
mm-hmm.
Spades, Pinochle.
Mm-hmm.
I played those kind of games, you know. And I go out and run. Like a friend there, we used to go out and walk, you know, walk the beaches,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Okay. How much alcohol use did you see going on?
It was heavy. The guys drank every night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the clubs, it was cheap because they didn't make that much money either. It was cheap. A lot of drinking, a lot of smoking, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I try to stay away from it, but I know the guys drinking a lot. I think it's maybe their word, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for them, but that's just my personal opinion.
Do you think it got in the way of their duties?
When it got right down to it, I don't think so.
Okay.
Because those guys, ones I seen and one what they done, I think they did what they had to do. Or I think they did the best they could.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my feelings from the Army, Marines, Navy, the ones I've seen, Coast Guard, even the CVs, Merchant Marines I've seen over there. I don't think it affected their jobs, and I've seen a bunch of them.
Why do you think there was such abuse of alcohol?
Because it was so easily available.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How about drug use?
Now, I never seen any drugs over there. You don't need to my drug when you said drug.
Marijuana, heroin, cocaine, anything besides alcohol.
Well, see, you couldn't have did that in my place of business. Where I was at, flying or whatever, the people I deal with,
mm-hmm.
you didn't play that game. You did that, you was out of business. So
you didn't see any of that in your unit?
Not in my unit.
Did you hear about it in other units?
We was told about the marijuana smoking and stuff like that. You know, if you smell it, they gave you, they tell you what it smells like, a burnt rope. You smell it, let somebody know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a friend that do it, you need to talk to the first shirt or tell the friend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See what you get them help. But now, you know, that was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we were aware, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You had other drugs out there. I think other alcohol. I remember something like 3-6s, something you could drink, some liquor or some other stuff they had over there. You know, but like I said, the names are Greek to me because I didn't do it. So.
Why didn't you do it?
I never drank or smoked. My father and mother, brothers and sisters, nobody drinks or smoke. My grandfather smoked a corn cob. I mean, he made that himself. So,
mm-hmm.
But I don't. It's something I just couldn't see wasting my money on.
Right.
And when we was in school, you got to smoke, drinking and smoking, you get your butt whooped.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't see getting no butt beating for something. No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do it today. I ain't going to do it tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, did you keep up with news from back in the United States when you were over in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, we used to listen at the news, the radio, and we read the Stars and Stripes. We got that every day, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
And that was free to us, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, they sold them, I think. But, We got the news every day, you know. Mm-hmm. And about going in and out of country, you read it. But you read a lot of things. I'm going to tell you, one thing that the news really did, they used to say, we lost 5 this week. And then when you was on an aircraft and you had an aircraft stacked halfway up, you know, what they mean, 5-foot of bodies, you
mm-hmm.
know. That used to kind of bother. Why did they say we got off 5 bodies and I got an aircraft full? And I know the other aircraft's lined up on the ramp, you
mm-hmm.
know. that kind of bugs you. Why do they tell the people the truth? How many people they really wish you're losing?
So you don't think the media really covered the war accurately?
I think they did what they was told to do.
Okay.
But I know it's more than five a week.
Uh-huh.
Because I've seen more than five a week.
You
know what I mean?
That's
me seeing and other people seeing. So I don't know if that's what they was given. But it wasn't covered like this current, what's going on now in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it had been like that, the American people might have dribbled it out there before then. You know, we lost a lot of people in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Awful lot.
Over 58,000.
Yeah. But we never lost over five a week.
What did you think of the media coverage of the war?
It was, at that day and time,
mm-hmm.
it was there. You know, but at this day and time, you know, it's better. It was technology. It's better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of places they wasn't allowed to go. They had to take what was given to them, you know, by the person of public affairs officers
mm-hmm.
of the different units. You know, they wasn't allowed out there in the mud and with the army units and all that, you know. So they had to get what they was given.
Did you ever have any reporters traveling with your unit?
Can't.
Okay, because of the classification.
Right.
Okay.
Even on trash haulers, we didn't.
Okay.
We didn't fly. Only civilians that I remember flying was Red Cross. Bob Hope flew on one of our aircraft when he was over there.
So you met Bob Hope?
I seen him, but I didn't meet him. I said, one of our aircraft he flown on.
Oh, one of them, not yours.
No.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the only civilians that ever come over there, you know, and the other, you know, like bringing them people into country, you know, the airlines,
mm-hmm.
you know. But that's about it, you know. As far as news reporters and stuff like that was limited, you know, where he was at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bob Hope, did you ever get to see any USO shows?
I only seen some, you know, but, you know, like in the clubs and stuff when they come over, or
mm-hmm.
out in they had the big old fields, you know, outfields in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
I seen some of those, yeah.
Okay.
But not that many.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that by choice or just you?
It wasn't in the area at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were those?
If we was there, if we wasn't on crew rest, you could go see anything you want, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you stay with, you know, like if somebody else want to go. You never went anywhere, my unit, by yourself.
Why
never.
Not?
Because of classification. You was like always, you know, looking out for the other guy. You was just like part of it. It was just that's the way it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever take any R&Rs?
No.
Okay. Tell me about your relationship with the other men. You said that you guys were really tight. Were there any kind of racial issues that you ran into?
None. Not on my unit.
Uh-huh.
Don't play that. None.
Uh-huh. How about when you went back to Seward and to Peace and Little Rock?
None.
Any problems?
None. Now, they had problems when I was in Japan, but that was up in Korea, but not in my unit. It was in April of one year.
Mm-hmm.
They had the same year they had in California. I think it was in 71, I think it was. They had a big race riot in California. Everywhere they was having them. They had them in the Philippines. They had them in California, North Carolina. But not in my unit. That was just a no-no.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you felt relatively safe and welcome?
Yeah. Everybody was welcome, you know. My life depended on yours, and yours depended on me. You know,
mm-hmm.
you didn't have anybody else. That was it. You
mm-hmm.
know? Yeah. you, like I said, you know. Using my weapon and I was your weapon. That's where you put it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had to depend on you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Cause some places might not be nobody but you and I, so.
Right.
You can't just. I don't have any enemies. I put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you were back in, I think, in Seward when Martin Luther King was killed.
I was on an aircraft headed to England when Martin Luther King got
really?
Killed. Yes. I was April the 4th. I was headed to Mills Knoll Air Force Base.
Tell me about how you were feeling, what you were thinking when you heard that.
I couldn't believe it. The pilot put it over the radio. Well, he was listening to the radio, and he put it on the radio, and the whole aircraft went like dead.
Hmm.
I can't believe this, you know. A lot of people start hollering, you know, and they're saying, no, I can't believe he did that, you know. But we was going to Milton Hall, TDY,
mm-hmm.
on a rotator.
How'd that affect you personally?
I just still couldn't believe it. It was just like when I was in school when JFK died, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The President of the United States gets shot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in the 12th grade when that happened, and then here I am in Tennessee, and then flying out of Tennessee, and
mm-hmm.
he got killed in Tennessee.
I know.
Yeah, so we was in we was leaving our largest field, going into Mildenhall on C-130.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for a rotator for 60 days, I think. Well, we was 60 or 90, but I think it was 60.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a cold feeling, I'll tell you that. You know, mm-hmm. just think people are not killing people in the U.S., just start killing people. You know, what's going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. But, you know, it keep going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask you a few other questions about just your time in general. Did you ever encounter any wild animals, anything like that? Vietnam, Southeast Asia is known for snakes.
Them big old lizards and snakes? Uh-huh. I'm not afraid of those. So I've seen them, yes.
What, were they in your plane, on the runway, in your
in the barracks? The lizards was in the barracks.
Right.
We never carried, even when we were moving the people, snakes. But they were snakes. We got to kill them. We'll catch them and put them out of the way.
Did they be in the aircraft?
You talking about lizards?
Or snakes. The snakes.
No. The only thing we had in the aircraft was pigs, chickens, and elephants. Never snakes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You had elephants in the aircraft?
Yes, we moved elephants before.
Wow.
In Thailand.
What was that like?
It was a big old shocker, worse than moving a tank. You had them, let me tell you something. The guy that had him, mm-hmm. when he told him to sit down, and we put the straps on him, he told him to sit down, and he stayed down. When the aircraft first took off, he kind of raised his head up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But when they had him strapped down, he wasn't going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I put it this way, he didn't go nowhere. I was open to the straps held him down. He was real disciplined. And when they got ready to land, they eased everything off and washed them a little bit
mm-hmm.
and told them about that guy felt that thing, whatever that thing in the face. And he backed them out. He backed that elephant off there. He took them off, sat down, got on them, and rode them off. So, you know, that's the only time I've seen an elephant on one. But I see a lot of pigs and stuff on them. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the other question, like snakes, no, I never see a snake on aircraft. It's just on the ground.
Okay. Okay. Did you guys have any pets?
They had a lizard. In the big old, one of them gray, big old, long lizards.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Okay. Okay. Were your religious views affected by your experience in being in the war?
I've been a Baptist most of all my life, but I've been to every church you can think of. I always go to church.
Mm-hmm.
I went to church over there if I could.
Where? Oh, in the Philippines or in Japan?
Every country I've been, I've been to church.
Okay.
I was brought up in the church, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Were your religious views changed any, intensified
none,
any because none, of the war?
None.
Okay.
I believe in, what I read. I believe when I was taught when I was a kid. I still believe in it. And then, Sunday, the church and the Easter,
mm-hmm.
I still go to church. It's not going to change that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Talking about the recreation entertainment, did you guys listen to a lot of music?
We had music. We had our own, in the barracks. They mm-hmm. had old jukeboxes. You can put your nickel in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we had music. You had everything you really need. I don't know if anything. You probably a little more freedom, but you had everything you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
The food wasn't the best, but it was the best that they had over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? MREs. A lot of them, the worst thing I guess you could have had, you look at the food place, potted eggs, When they get cold, they turn green, but you eat them. So, you had plenty of food,
Right.
What we had, the powdered milk that was made into milk or the orange juice, was the best they had, and that's
mm-hmm.
what they gave us,
Mm-hmm.
You get all you want to eat, It wasn't the day that I didn't want to eat, even midnight meals they had.
Mm-hmm.
So the food was no problem. Now, I know the guys out in the field when they came in, it was a little different, but
mm-hmm.
I was right there in a unit, Well, we
mm-hmm.
went out on a flight. We took our meals with us,
mm-hmm.
like in the flight kitchen. We had cold cuts, but then sometimes you had fried chicken, but we could heat it up on the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't complain about the food.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember any particular songs that you enjoyed while you were there in country?
Not really. I remember Bear Sullivan. I remember the... What's there, Free to Pain? They made all kinds of songs. I think a lot of the songs you really listen to,
mm-hmm.
and you laugh about, was the ones they come out, like Bring the Boys Home or Barry Sullivan when he made his song,
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that really get you when the Star Spangled Banner is playing,
mm-hmm.
or something like that, the,
mm-hmm.
really the flag is raised and
mm-hmm.
A member of the military armed forces, somebody go down,
mm-hmm.
that's what bothers you. Taps, probably the worst one,
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's gone,
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, songs were songs, and time flew by.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you work any with the New Zealanders, Australians, or the South Koreans?
When we was in the 834th, we worked with them, and that was no more than Like if they couldn't get in to get something, or they had something that they couldn't carry, like on the 123s that they was flying.
You're talking about the Australians?
The Australians, yeah. Uh-huh. If they couldn't carry something, you know, we would help them. If they need some help on the aircraft, they couldn't do it, or they need pause, or they need, you know, whatever, we would help them.
Okay.
You know, to the extent. That's when I was like trash hours. We could, you know, we were real people. We could talk to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you work with the Koreans, you know, you work with them all, you know.
What was your impression of the South Koreans?
Didn't bother me. They was good people. And I was been TDY up there, and those are true military personnel.
Really?
They're really true American people.
Mm-hmm.
They really believe in us. And I tell you what, if we had to ask somebody to stand by you, they'll stand by you. The Australians will stand by you, the Englands. You know, when you go to those countries, you can tell the Army and the Armed Forces members that are stand by you.
Mm-hmm.
And when we was over there, they stood by us.
Mm-hmm.
From day one to the day we left, they was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. How would you describe the leadership you had in Vietnam and Southeast Asia?
Some of the best there were.
Really?
Yeah.
From your immediate supervisors all the way up?
That's right. I can't complain about any one of them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. What did you think of the overall military leadership for the United States in Vietnam?
Never question it. I think they did. All orders come down from the top to
mm-hmm.
the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't question orders. We just did what we was told to do, and we believed it was for the good of the country,
mm-hmm.
For us
mm-hmm.
as a whole, the people.
Mm-hmm.
So when Johnson, Kennedy, I wasn't really there for Kennedy, but Johnson, Humphrey, and all the rest of the guys, you know, to Nixon. I think one of the greatest things Nixon did was to get us out of Vietnam. Then when you thought about it in 75, well, you asked that, you questioned it, but then you said the time he made that decision was what the people wanted to be made. He made it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think one of the best leaders we had was Nixon, you know. In fact, I voted for him the second time around, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, so... You know, you look at it both ways, but I think we offer all good leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They did what they did at the time to satisfy the people that voted them in or satisfy the country to try to keep the country going.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, our country was kind of wishy-washy, you know, was up and down, you know. But people had jobs, some didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But we was trying to move forward at the same time, trying to pull another country behind us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big load on a president, you know, to try to satisfy all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there a particular brave incident that you remember from your time over there?
Brave?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. You know, not over there. When you said brave, just surviving, jumping in a ditch and getting out, you know,
mm-hmm.
from a mortar attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's. I can tell you an incident where kids, you know, were come through the gate, and I remember, you know, I was like, this is at Cameron Bay. Kids try to come through the gate. They tell you about these kids, how, you know, good kids, you play with them.
Mm-hmm.
They was coming through the gate, and the kids had grenades. And when they shook this guy's hand, he looked up there, he see the wire. She was getting ready to stretch her fingers out. She was going to pull the pin.
Mm-hmm.
That's what woke me up about the kids over there. I said, oh, Lord, you know, even the kids against us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the brave incidents on me, I did my job. I did whatever I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't consider any of them brave. I consider the job I had to do, I did the best I could.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a particular humorous incident that you remember from your time there?
Humorous,
uh-huh.
Yes, sure. All of it was funny. Sometimes when the guys go out and get blasted and you're the only one that don't drink in the unit, you had to go home and get a truck and bring them home. That's humorous. You laugh about that. We even laugh about that when we come in. You know, we talk. Like if they have this reunion, they put that one pretty soon, I think, in Mississippi. They put that one down at the 130 unit. In fact, I got a call not too long ago about it.
Mm-hmm.
Would I go come down? They were thinking about having one, and we laugh about that all the time. You know, I was the only one that drove that
mm-hmm.
didn't drink, you know.
So you were the designated driver.
I was the designated driver before that word came out. A lot of times I'd be sleeping. They said somebody over there to get bring the company truck. You know, I was old, lost. And then, but believe it or not now, they didn't have to fly the next day. These guys, that when they did something like that, they wasn't flying the next day.
Mm-hmm.
They may fly the next night, but our guys did not fly drinking or nothing like that. You know?
Okay.
They was sober and ready to go.
Okay.
So make that very clear. You know, our guys
right.
were straight up when they got ready to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you ever sense any tension between people who were serving in the rear than people who were out in the field?
There was a different attitude and behavior problem, and
mm-hmm.
you could understand that. Because the guys that was out there getting shot at every day,
mm-hmm.
when they did come in and see how the guys was living, like in the bases that didn't go out and get shot at,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had a behavior problem because they would come in and they would go to a child, now they're eating hot food, not MREs. They're not sleeping in the mud. They're sleeping in beds, you know. You can see that in their face, but believe it or not, I don't think they ever took it out on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was their job, and they did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones on the base would support people. Now, a lot of guys on the base been shot at too, but the guys in the field didn't know nothing about it.
Right.
You know, because they used to have snipers around walk around on the base. So, but the guy that was in the field, the Army guys, the Marines, stuff like that, that was out on Monkey Mountain and all those places,
mm-hmm.
those guys caught it. You know,
mm-hmm.
they caught it. Because I've been out there in the units to have to resupply them or go out and pick them up and bring them in. And those guys lived a rough life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't know who to shoot at or who, you know, which one of the races, you know, north or south they're shooting at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a guy walk in and shoot your best friend that you thought was a southern, south Vietnamese was an off end. What you going to do, you know? That mm-hmm. has a big toll on you.
Did you talk to these guys when you go pick them up?
Well, a lot of times, if you talk, like I said, they talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's that simple. You know, you don't egg anyone. You talk to them, you know. You're all big armed forces, you know. But they was a different breed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These guys that see death like daily,
mm-hmm.
taking life. You know, taking life from a person. A lot of people don't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
To take a person's life, you live with the rest of your life. And that's a different feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You can come home and say you forget it, but you won't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mr. Harrison, why don't we talk a little bit about when you came back to the United States after the Philippines. This is 1977. Let's talk about your general impressions of the war in Vietnam. Did you find that people were asking you about Vietnam War, even those times when you came back to Seward and to peace, were people asking you about the war, or was it kind of just people didn't care, or what?
Some would ask. The only one that really would ask was maybe the military people. Civilian
mm-hmm.
people really didn't ask that much at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the military people were the ones that really asked, were the ones about ready to get ready to go over.
Right.
Yeah, that was about it. You know, your parents, you know, they always wanted to know, but really they wanted to know and they didn't want to know. Because, you know, the experience you go through,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it was in pain, you know, they didn't want to know if the kid went through pain or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the best thing about it, he wasn't a POW, and your friends made it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about it, you know.
Did you have any trouble at the airports with the civilians, any problems related to the anti-war movement?
No.
Okay.
None.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What did you think of the anti-war movement?
I thought it was inappropriate for the states. I thought it was like showing disrespect to the troops and the people,
mm-hmm.
you know. But like I said, that was their beliefs, you know. But because the ones that probably was out there really probably needed to really be for. Because to me, when a country do whatever it's doing, whether it's right or wrong, I think everybody should ride around them. And when it's over and done, that's when you should go out and say, put all these thoughts together and say, well, will it really work for it or not,
mm-hmm.
you know. Because, to me, you know, there's still a lot of questions about Vietnam, about all the people that are missing, you know. What did we accomplish, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What did we learn? You know, you put all that together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now somebody have, because this is the last, all the conflicts that happened after that,
mm-hmm.
it was done different.
Okay.
And we have taken less casualties, we spent less time. You know, we went in and did what you had to do and come on back, you know. I hope that the one we got now going on do the same thing.
So you think the United States learned some lessons?
I think they learned a great lesson.
Don't let
the civilians run the war. Let the generals run it.
Okay.
I think that was the big mistake in Vietnam. Personally, that the civilians was calling the do's and don'ts, and they should have let the generals. Like, I think really Vietnam, if they really wanted to do it, they could have did it in
mm-hmm.
no time at all. Because like I said, they wasn't really fighting. The aircraft we had, air superiority, you know,
mm-hmm.
we had control of the air. Because the only thing they had that I seen personally was old MiGs, 15s and 17s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later on, they did have some, you know, the big, the 19s. But, you know, we had the F-105s. We had we had more jets, you know, that they did. And, you know, it was a challenge. You know, most of the fighting that we did was really ground, guerrilla type, you know,
mm-hmm.
over there. So, to come back home and see somebody stand out there holler, you know, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that. You know, it's just like, I compare that like saying abortion, you know.
I'm sorry? Like what?
I compare that to the people that said, like, abortions and stuff like that.
Abortion?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, they fight something. A lot of people don't even know what they're fighting, you know. They start to have got their followers. They're following other people because mm-hmm. that's what they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
You got to stand up and be account for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, if I had to do it all over again, yes, I would do it all over again, you know, because mm-hmm. I believe in the country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only going to get better. It's not going to get worse. We learned from Vietnam. We learned, and I think the country learned one of the best lessons ever. I think they learned more than they learned from World War One, World War Two, because we fought it different,
mm-hmm.
you know. But and if you remember anything after that, we fought it, I think, with generals running it versus civilians.
What do you think the United States could have done different in Vietnam if the generals had been running the war to win the war?
Different? They would have went in there and fought it completely different. They'd have fought about like the end when Nixon ended it. They went in there and they just took totally control. They went into the north and took out the north. Instead of bombing the south every day, mm-hmm. they'd been bombing the north, and that would have changed the whole war.
Okay.
Because we jumped, majority of the bombs, if you remember right, was dropped in South Vietnam, the country we was defending. If we'd have went to the north more than what we did, it would have been a complete different picture.
You know, more bombs are dropped on Laos than on Vietnam.
That's what I'm talking about, you know.
What about the United States activities in Laos? Did you agree with the fact that we were actually over there when we weren't supposed to be there?
Laos, Cambodia, and all those
mm-hmm.
countries?
Mm-hmm.
We was over there way before anybody ever thought we was over there, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody talking about we wasn't there when we were there. When, you know, that was a lot of things. A lot of places, that wasn't the only place we was at, but, you know, like, mm-hmm. we can't talk about it, but, you know, we were in a lot of places over there. We wasn't supposed to be over there, where mm-hmm. Where we were. That came out late on that the people spoke about, you know. So I think anywhere we go, we should be able to stand up and say, yeah, we was there. But I guess we don't.
Do you think that, I mean, the United States government's recognized all of our activities in Laos to this point, except for some of the classified missions. But do you think that the United States should have put ground troops into Laos? A lot of people advocate that. You know, we should have cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail in half. We should have put a division in Laos and let it hold the country. What do you think about that theory?
Well, you had people on the ground in Laos. I don't know what people say you didn't, but
well, I'm talking about putting a division, an
division,
army division.
Our own division? I don't know. You know, if you'd have cut off the supply routes like mm-hmm. they did on U.S., well, they call it number one over there in Vietnam. If you cut off the supply routes from the north, Laos, Cambodia, and all mm-hmm. that, we wouldn't have had the problem. You know,
mm-hmm.
it would have just been dead. It would have been dead, you know. We wouldn't have had to worry about people running back and forth, telling about how we were, and, you know, that's what was said to be done. A lot of Vietnamese south in the day and north at night. But we would have cut that off. And, you know, we'd have saved a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of life. We'd have been living today.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have did that away.
Okay. Looking back at your service, how do you feel about your service? You said you're proud of it.
Every day of it.
Okay.
I did the best I could, what I had.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would change about your experiences in Southeast Asia if you could?
No, not really. You know, what I did was keep an aircraft flying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can't change that. You know, you do the best you can, you know,
mm-hmm.
and be proud of everything you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back at it, everything I've done, you know, I never did anything to keep it from flying. I did everything I could do and possibly could do to keep it to fly, so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm okay.
What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there?
In Vietnam?
Yes, sir.
Learn to survive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest thing. Survive and be sure that the ones around you, you know, survive, you know. Togetherness, you know, that's about it. You know, mm-hmm. one big family, you survive. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay. How do you think the war experience has most affected your life? You stayed in the Air Force for quite a while after
28 years.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that the more you try, the better you do it, to follow directions, and if you find a better way to do it, you spread the rumor, you know, you reach out, and then at the same time you pull the ones behind you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't just take care of yourself, you also take care of the people behind you. And that's why I think I got where I got to be, you know, by taking care of myself and taking care of the one not only behind me and the ones in front of me. You do the best job you can, and you will exceed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told many times that I would not get where I, you know, gotten, but I didn't believe it because I knew that I could do better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
that's why I think I did what I done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would you want to ever go back to Vietnam?
No, not really.
Why not?
Not really. I just don't, you know, like I said, the country was dirty and nasty, mm-hmm. you know, and I never had to live in, you know, by choice in an area, and that would be a choice I have, and I wouldn't want to take that choice,
mm-hmm.
you know, not Vietnam, no.
Okay.
I've seen too many good kids die, you know, things like that, you know, you'll bring back, you know, kids that died over there,
mm-hmm.
now we're going to go back over there and look at them and spend money and help their economy?
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I couldn't do that.
What do you think about the country today?
Today, as a whole?
Yes, sir. The Vietnam, not the United States.
No, I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I wish them well. I really do. You know, I have nothing to hold against them. You know, the people together, and I wish them well. That's all I can say, you know.
Okay. Do you think the United States should have official relations with them and be involved with Vietnam or not?
Not the way we left out, I don't.
Okay.
You know, we left out running, and now we're going to run back. And this help the same people that will not account for all the people that, you know, lost lives, and I know they know better. And the way they treated the POWs, you know, they didn't comply with the Geneva Convention or nothing, you know. So, well, no, I don't think we should have went back and spent one red cent there.
So you kind of hold a grudge against them?
Not really. I think that's no more than fair. If, you know, what they did, I guess, was their way of surviving. What we did was the way that we was following rules, you know, we was following what we was told to do.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I don't think we should spend one red cent over there. I really don't. I think we spent enough money already.
Mm-hmm.
We gave them everything we left. You know, that was an awful lot. And we could have gave that to countries, as school systems, they need that money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gone, you know.
One big criticism Martin Luther King had about the war is that all the billions of dollars spent over there could have been spent at home for better things.
Yes, I'm talking about schools and
uh-huh.
stuff like that for the kids that don't have it, you know. And we walked away and left all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we really just gave it away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Oh, I've seen them all the time. Many of them, you know, when I was in Arkansas, you had Fort Smith. They brought loads and loads of them there, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
No, that don't bother me. You know, I can deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that don't bother me at all. That never crossed my mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you suffer any disabilities from your service in Southeast Asia?
No more than colorblindness. No,
okay.
I'm all right. I don't bother. I keep looking forward.
So no post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms or anything?
No, don't bother.
Okay. You're taking your grandfather's advice then.
You got that right.
Mm-hmm.
You don't let it bother.
Do you read books on the Vietnam War?
No, I really don't.
Why not?
It's in the past, and I got pictures and stuff. I look at them, you know, and I laugh, you know,
mm-hmm.
keep on going, you know. And like I said, don't bother.
Mm-hmm. How about movies on the war? Do you go see movies about Vietnam?
The ones you see really is not true for what I experienced over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen some on television. I would never go pay to go see a movie, no. But the one I seen on TV, you know, they always go show the good guy going in and he's doing this and that.
Mm-hmm.
It never happened, you know, so I laugh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you see some of the way they live over there, and living over there that long and seeing what everybody started out with and what we ended up with,
mm-hmm.
you laugh about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the jungles, and like I see, two or three months ago they had the movie on where somebody going in and get people out, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the bamboo and how they kept the prisoners in the cages in the grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I see those cages in the ground flying up high, you know, and wasn't nobody in them. By the time they went in to evacuate the people, and wasn't nobody in those cages, you know, so. Bamboo, they look about the same, but they really weren't as nasty as they were, you know,
mm-hmm.
the holes in the walls and stuff. So
they were nastier or not as nasty?
They was nastier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, why do you think that Hollywood can't get it right about Vietnam?
Because they didn't have the news reporters and stuff in there to get true pictures.
Okay.
That's why they can't get it.
Okay.
Yeah. If they only knew the true picture, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think the American people would have had a different view of it. Like this war they got going on, from day one they was there, and they later on they, you know, ease out. But the coverage of the war, you know, back then they didn't have the technology they have today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference, I think, the people understanding what really was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you tell young people today about the Vietnam War?
If you got to go, do the best job you can. You know, don't question it, just do it, and then you see a way you can do it better, spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
do the best you can. You know, don't take no shortcuts. Tell them. Sometimes the long way around is the best way. You know, that's all I can tell them. You know, I wouldn't tell them to volunteer and go. You know what I mean? I never tell them to volunteer, but I tell them if you got any doubt at all, that's not the place to be. You know, but if you're just curious and want to learn and expand your life, you know, make your own choice. You know, that's your own choice.
Okay. What do you tell your children about your experiences in Vietnam?
Really, you know, if they ask, I tell them the truth. You know, what I can tell them. Yeah.
Okay. How do you think the government's treated Vietnam veterans over the years?
Not fair.
Why do you think that?
Because it's true. You know, what we was promised, and we don't get it today. You know, like the things that I went through, and even the ones that go to the VA, you know, they go by, you know, what the disability is and all that stuff. And some of these guys are really hurt. You know, some of these guys went through a lot. You know, you've seen it. You brought them home, you know, crippled and cradle, you know. They was promised Medicare and all that stuff. It's not there because the government don't have to. They say it's money that the VA hospitals don't have. They don't have the doctors. They don't have the money. And then the military hospitals, but they're mostly all closing. The one, well, there's probably no Vietnam vets left unless it's some old generals. But that be 75. We might have a couple of people that left 30. 2005 be all your enlisted people out of there. But they didn't keep any promise. Even the, you know, the medical, I don't even get free medical and all that stuff that was promised. You know, you have to pay for anything you get. So, no, they don't treat them right. They what was there and the ones that was hurt, it's just not there.
When did you get out of the Air Force? What year?
1993, August.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you're not, you don't feel like you're getting the care that you deserve?
I know I'm not. I have to pay for whatever I get.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
I passed by. It was here. They had a replica of it here.
The moving wall?
Right. They had it here. It's something, you know, it's something, you know, to see that, you know. But, yeah, so.
What were your feelings, your experiences when you saw that?
About like, a, you know, it's not quite like a national cemetery. You know, I've been many of those, you know, the pass by Arlington and all those places. You know, where you see all those military guys out there, you know, and the families, you know, whatever, you know, we got out there. But when you just see that, it's just, you know, it could have been you, you know. So, you know, but then you look at that wall and you really think, is it all those names there? You know what I mean? You know, so that's, it's a different feeling. It's something you just sit there, you know, wonder, you know. Yeah, so, but you go on.
Well, Mr. Harrison, is there anything else that you want to add to our conversation today that we haven't talked about?
No, not really. You know, that's the way it is. You know, if I had anything to say, you know, for our government, that for the people that's coming on today, if they promise them something, they'll stand by. Like the people in Vietnam, they promise to take care of them. They should do it. That's all I got to say, you know.
Okay.
Don't tell them you're going to do it, and then when it's over, to make them pay for what little they can get. And that's where a lot of today, they have a problem with recruitment in the military because I would never tell my son to do it or my daughter because the promise they make, they won't keep. And that's what's hurting recruitment now in the military. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and end the interview with Mr. Wilson Harrison. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, I appreciate it, sir.
Yes, sir.